que protegen temporalmente a indocumentados de la deportación.
Estas movidas son muy políticas, obviamente, están haciendo un llamado a los elementos más racistas, más conservadores, más miedosos en este país.
Isabel García es vocera de la Coalición de Derechos Humanos con sede en Tucson, Arizona.
Ellos también saben que las elecciones ya las han manejado de cierto modo, lo que le dicen el gerrymandering, donde ellos hacen las fronteras de cada distrito como les gusta para poder controlar, hacen medidas para que la gente no pueda votar como antes. Después de que los negros empezaron a votar, hubo una estrategia muy específica, Southern Strategy, para prohibir a los negros que voten. Es lo que está pasando aquí.
Las medidas aprobadas por los republicanos no solo anulan la orden ejecutiva de diferir deportaciones para entre 4 y 5 millones indocumentados, como dos tercios de ellos mexicanos, sino que desmantelan la orden anteriormente otorgada por la Casa Blanca en 2012 para proteger de la deportación a más de 500,000 indocumentados que llegaron aquí como menores de edad, los llamados dreamers o soñadores.
Ven que los jóvenes, los soñadores en particular, ellos los ven como un elemento muy peligroso porque no nomás son muchos, sino que llevan una política progresista más que ningún otro sector en este país, que buscan justicia, saben sus derechos y como que les tienen miedo en vez de realmente abrazarlos y ver que esta población va a ser la salvación de este país.
Las medidas formuladas por los republicanos fueron enganchadas como enmiendas a un proyecto de ley sobre el presupuesto del Departamento de Seguridad Interna. Dicho departamento no solo se encarga de asuntos de migración, sino de los programas antiterroristas al interior del país, incluyendo protección de fronteras, costas e infraestructura, y cuyo financiamiento actual expira a fines de febrero. Por lo tanto, su aprobación se considera urgente, o sea, la jugada es atrever a Obama a que ponga en riesgo la seguridad a cambio de su protección de migrantes. García señala que el argumento de que para bloquear las órdenes ejecutivas del presidente Obama hay que impactar el presupuesto carece de solidez, pues el dinero que los migrantes pagan al hacer su solicitud cubre los gastos necesarios.
El programa corre por sí mismo, es decir, mucha gente no sabe que el proceso de migración, todos los procesos que hacemos, es financiado por la misma persona haciendo su solicitud, por eso hay cantidades de 485, 600, es decir, es un negocio dentro del gobierno que se paga por sí mismo por la misma gente. Ahora son tan malos que dicen que aún esos costos, estos costos que se le pone al aplicante, que eso no se puede utilizar para procesar ninguno.
La abogada subraya que un gran grupo de norteamericanos está atemorizado ante el crecimiento numérico de grupos minoritarios y les aterra la idea de que ellos, los blancos, se convertirán en minoría.
Realmente los ricos manipulan mucho de eso, pero están manipulando el racismo en vez de enfocarse en problemas y van a causar mucho más problemas. Pero lo que está pasando aquí, no debemos de sorprendernos que mientras estamos aumentando más de población y que casi todos los días hablan de que los blancos van a ser una minoría, están manejando, explotando el cambio de la composición de este país, en cierto modo, y no quieren perder control.
El proyecto de ley, junto con las enmiendas, aún tiene que ser aprobado por el Senado, el cual, aún con su nueva mayoría republicana, podría no lograr reunir los 60 votos necesarios. A la vez, algunos republicanos, ya con vistas a la coyuntura de las elecciones presidenciales de 2016, no comparten la visión antimigrante de sus colegas en la Cámara de Representantes. García dice que el actuar de los grupos antimigrantes se parece cada día más a la antigua Sudáfrica y su racismo institucionalizado conocido como apartheid.
Tenemos simplemente que ver a Sudáfrica, que el modo que una minoría pequeñita pudo seguir controlando a los millones y millones de negros, pues fue un sistema de apartheid, y es lo que están tratando de criar en este país sin decir apartheid.
Por su parte, el líder de la Cámara Baja del Congreso, John Boehner, reafirmó que Obama está actuando ignorando al pueblo, ignorando la Constitución y hasta sus propias posiciones anteriores en torno al control de migración. La abogada Isabel García recalcó que es curioso ver a esos políticos supuestamente defendiendo la Constitución cuando ellos frecuentemente ignoran la Carta Magna con sus violaciones de los derechos de los migrantes.
Estamos creando un sistema muy parecido part-time para poder seguir el control en las manos de unos pocos y que sean norteamericanos blancos.
Los republicanos tienen 54 de los 100 curules en el Senado, pero para aprobar un proyecto de ley se requiere un mínimo de 60 votos y por ahora no cuentan con tal apoyo. Por tanto, tendrán que negociar una versión modificada para atraer algunos votos de demócratas conservadores. Luego está la amenaza real del veto presidencial de Barack Obama. Analistas aseguran que en realidad se trata de una maniobra política de los republicanos para activar sus bases y prepararlas para las elecciones presidenciales de 2016. Predictiblemente, dicen, los republicanos una vez más usan el racismo para intentar ganar la contienda electoral. En Los Ángeles, yo soy Fernando Velázquez.
Tú nos dices que debemos sentarnos, pero las ideas solo pueden levantarnos, caminar, correr, no rendirse ni retroceder, ver, aprender cómo esponja absorbe. Nadie sobre todos, faltan todos, suman todos para todos.
Estás escuchando el Informativo Pacífica.
Te invitamos a que te unas a nuestras redes sociales por Twitter en info-pacífica o por Facebook bajo el nombre de nuestro productor Fernando Velázquez e Informativo Pacífica. Escucha el noticiero cada día de lunes a viernes en Pueblos Sin Fronteras wordpress.com.
En Guatemala, comunidades indígenas reprobaron la gestión del presidente Otto Pérez Molina.
El gobierno de Otto Pérez Molina vuelve a reprobar en una evaluación de sus 3 años de gobierno, pues según un análisis realizado por el Observatorio de Pueblos Indígenas, son nulos los avances en materia de desarrollo. Según Mary Itzep, las acciones impulsadas por el gobierno no han respondido a las necesidades de los pueblos indígenas.
Se ha creado un gabinete indígena que no ha avanzado. Lo dijimos al inicio que era un gabinete folclórico y que este gabinete, pues hemos confirmado durante un año de acción, nada, digamos, se ha hecho en materia de los pueblos indígenas y vemos que el tema de los pueblos indígenas está totalmente abandonado por parte del presidente de la República.
Por otro lado, en 2014 aumentó la criminalización de los defensores de los derechos colectivos. Además, la conflictividad social no fue bien abordada por las autoridades.
Que hay un aumento sobre la criminalización de los derechos colectivos y en este caso se han documentado alrededor de 1.200 puntos de conflictividad social, la cual durante 3 años solo se han dado tratamiento a 7 conflictos sin resolución o sin que se han resuelto alguna de estos 7. El caso Barías, Huehuetenango, el caso San Juan Zacatepeques, en el caso Monteolivo, por ejemplo, este año 2014 fue uno de los terribles asesinatos cometidos por parte del gobierno y las fuerzas de seguridad, en el caso la masacre ocurrida de 2 campesinos, en el caso Monteolivo en Alta Verapaz y el caso San Juan Zacatepeques, causado por el gobierno y la seguridad nacional del estado.
Reportó Carolina Rivas.
Inició en México la búsqueda ciudadana de los 42 normalistas desaparecidos por policías del municipio de Iguala, en Guerrero, el pasado 26 de septiembre. Ante la falta de acciones del gobierno federal, padres y madres, compañeros y sociedad civil iniciaron el miércoles la búsqueda, protegidos por policías comunitarios de la montaña de Guerrero. Raimundo Pérez informa.
Desde temprano en la normal rural de Ayotzinapa se alistaron los padres de familia para iniciar por su cuenta la búsqueda de sus hijos. Eleocadio Ortega busca a su hijo Mauricio.
Lo que llevo es la ropa, la cobija y la chamarra, el machete. Cualquier necesidad que vaya donde nos vamos a quedar, pues ahí tenemos que limpiar con el machete algo, pues, y la búsqueda pues va a estar muy difícil.
Los familiares de los estudiantes desaparecidos por policías municipales de Iguala enfilarán sus esfuerzos hacia la Sierra de Guerrero, territorio controlado por grupos de delincuencia organizada.
Hemos recibido amenazas, pues de que si vamos, pues nos van a matar, ¿no?, por parte de la delincuencia, porque bueno, está claro, ¿no?, el amaciato que existe entre el gobierno y ellos, porque si no, ¿qué tendría que ver la delincuencia organizada en este asunto si lo que buscamos únicamente es a los 43?
Hasta Ayotzinapa llegaron grupos de policías comunitarios provenientes de la montaña de Guerrero. Algunos portaban armas para brindar seguridad a los contingentes de ciudadanos.
Van de San Luis Acatlán, de Olinalá, de Huamuztitlán y de la Casa Justicia Espino Blanco.
La búsqueda ciudadana se origina luego de que los padres consideraran infructuosas las investigaciones de las policías federales para localizar a sus hijos a casi 4 meses de su desaparición.
Por eso vamos directamente nosotros, todos los padres de familia, vamos a buscar en el cerro, en los hoyos, donde cualquier parte de la sierra, pues vamos a entrar.
Informamos, ya vamos ahorita a partir, vamos a abordar los autobuses.
Cinco horas después de lo previsto, el contingente partió. De Ayotzinapa a Iguala será el primer tramo del recorrido que harán los padres de familia en esta búsqueda ciudadana para encontrar a sus hijos. En Iguala los padres tuvieron reunión de organización. Este municipio será el punto de partida para la búsqueda de los 43 estudiantes de Ayotzinapa desaparecidos. Raimundo Pérez Arellano, Telesur, Guerrero, México.
En los últimos años, comunidades mexicanas azotadas por la violencia han organizado grupos de autodefensa para enfrentar a la delincuencia organizada coludida con autoridades y policías. Los gobiernos de Felipe Calderón y Enrique Peña Nieto han intentado desarticularlas encarcelando a sus líderes. Uno de los casos más destacados es el de Nestora Salgado, comandante de la Policía Comunitaria de Olinala en Guerrero, presa desde hace casi año y medio. Pese a que el Poder Judicial ha ordenado su liberación, todavía continúa encarcelada en una prisión del estado de Nayarit. A continuación, un comentario sobre el caso de Nestora Salgado.
Mi nombre es Ana Quintero, soy miembro del Comité Free Nestora Los Ángeles y de la Coalición Latinoamericana por Ayotzinapa, también aquí en Los Ángeles. La comandante de la Policía Comunitaria de Olinalá, Guerrero, Nestora Salgado, sigue presa en el penal de alta seguridad del Cerezo, Nayarit, a pesar de haber sido exonerada desde abril del 2014 por el juez federal magistrado del primer tribunal unitario, José Luis Arroyo Alcántar. Las condiciones de vida a la que la tienen sometida son muy precarias. Está confinada a un cuarto blanco de 3x3 metros, sin ventanas y con la luz prendida a las 24 horas. Ahí, en total aislamiento, se ha consumido por más de 17 meses, sobreviviendo con una escuálida dieta de atún. Los medicamentos que necesita por su neuropatía solo se le suministraron una semana, porque los abogados de la Universidad de Seattle, de la Corte Interamericana de Derechos Humanos, se los demandó. Pero por el contrario, le han querido obligar a tomar un cóctel de pastillas diferentes sin explicarle para qué son. Ella se ha rehusado a ingerirlos. Se le obliga además a que firme declaraciones de que recibe terapias y tratamientos que no se le dan. Solamente le autorizan una visita cada 12 días de su hija Zaira y su hermana Cleotilde, quienes tienen que recorrer casi 1,000 millas en un viaje de 24 horas y gastar lo que no tienen en un boleto de autobús desde Olinalá hasta Nayarit, para poder ir a darle ánimos a Nestora. Ellas relatan lo doloroso que es verla en grilletes y cómo, a pesar de su gran fortaleza, ella se está deteriorando. 17 meses sin actividad y sin ver el sol a diario es demasiado para una mujer que ama la vida, la gente y la naturaleza. La represión a Nestora no solamente le afecta a ella, su familia está devastada emocional y económicamente, sufriendo represalias. A su tío, negociante de la construcción, el trabajo que antes le llegaba en abundancia ahora le escasea, y a sus pequeños nietos se les ha negado la inscripción en las escuelas públicas. Las autoridades mexicanas violan los derechos humanos y constitucionales con un dolo intolerable y con una impunidad imperdonable. Nestora está siendo secuestrada, ya que el juez Arroyo Alcántar dictó auto de libertad por los delitos de secuestro agravado y de delincuencia organizada que se le imputaron, y dijo que dichos delitos no eran aplicables a Nestora, puesto que la policía comunitaria no puede concebirse como una organización criminal, ya que forma parte del sistema estatal de seguridad pública de Guerrero. Por lo tanto, desestimó los cargos y ordenó la liberación de la comandanta. Recientemente, el mismo gobernador de Guerrero, Rogelio Ortega, le solicitó a la Fiscalía Estatal que desistiera de esos 48 cargos de supuesto secuestro que le imputan. Llamaron secuestro a los 48 arrestos que la policía comunitaria realizó en el periodo de tiempo que Nestora estuvo a cargo, pero ella como comandanta solo arrestó a 12 delincuentes, mismos que retenían en diferentes casas de la justicia, pequeñas prisiones de la policía comunitaria, donde en vez de castigar, se reeduca al infractor. En los 7 meses que ella estuvo como comandanta, disminuyó el crimen en un 90%, pero el arresto infraganti del síndico del pueblo, robándose una vaca, fue el detonador para la persecución de Nestora. La arrestaron con un operativo militar que incluyó tanquetas, camionetas y hasta un helicóptero, y todo eso solo como castigo por evidenciar la estrecha relación entre los gobernantes corruptos y los criminales de Lampa organizada, que solo quieren desestabilizar la paz del pueblo, generar caos y así darle un pretexto al gobierno represivo para atacar y desalojar a las comunidades indígenas, despojarlas de sus propiedades y matarlas si se resisten. Nestora se resistió y no la han matado aún, pero lo están haciendo poco a poco, jugando con su mente, con las frías y calculadas movidas maquiavélicas de la perversidad de los infames políticos mexicanos. Al encarcelarla, pretendieron detener la organización de las comunidades indígenas, que valientemente se organizan para protegerse de los criminales, quienes, aliados con el mal gobierno, aterrorizan a la población con robos, extorsiones, secuestros, torturas, desapariciones y muertes. Nestora representa la flama infalible del coraje del pueblo que busca establecer una sociedad justa, libre y democrática. Esa flama no se extinguirá. Esa flama es la conciencia de un pueblo que se quita las vendas de los ojos y ve la triste realidad de un México en manos asesinas, pero está dispuesto a dar su vida por construir un futuro mejor para sus hijos. Nestora Salgado es una líder ejemplar de cómo un ser humano común, una madre, una emigrante campesina, una ardua trabajadora, puede cambiar al mundo. Ella, en vez de estar en la cárcel, debería estar enderezando a este país. Mi nombre es Ana Quintero, soy miembro del Comité Free Nestora Los Ángeles y de la Coalición Latinoamericana por Ayotzinapa, también aquí en Los Ángeles.
Para informarse más sobre el caso de Nestora Salgado, pueden visitar el sitio freenestora.org. Hemos llegado al final de otra edición del Informativo Pacífica. A nombre del compañero Toshli y del director del proyecto, Fernando Velázquez, se despide Norma Martínez.
Coming up next, Informativo Pacífica.
A continuación.
And of course, you're listening to Free Radio Santa Cruz. And coming up next, it's Bathrobes, Piers, Broadsides, with anecdotal coverage of the last Santa Cruz City Council meeting, such as it was. Stay tuned, and we'll listen in together.
I'm tired of moon songs, of star and of June songs. They simply make me nap. And ditties romantic drive me frantic. I think they're all full of pap. History's making, nations are quaking. Why sing of stars above? For while we are waiting, Father Time's creating new things to be singing of. Sing me a song with social significance. All other tunes are taboo. I want a ditty with heat in it, appealing with feeling and meat in it. Sing me a song with social significance, or you can sing till you're blue. Let meaning shine from every line, or I won't love you. Sing me of wars and sing me of breadlines. Tell me of front page news. Sing me of strikes and last minute headlines. Dress your observation in syncopation. Sing me a song with social significance. There's nothing else that will do. It must get hot with what is what, or I won't love you. I want a song that's satirical, putting the mere into miracle.
This is Bathrobes, Piers, Broadsides. I'm Robert Norris, and the call-in number to this talk show, and that's what this is, we talk, I talk a lot, you can talk too, is 427-3772, area code 831 in case you're out of the area. I don't know what to do if you're out of the country, but you probably do, so call in, give us reports, particularly concerned with the fate of folks outside those on the streets, people with less power than those in the suites, so to speak. Yeah. So I've got numerous street interviews I'm probably going to run through, but the... one of the main things I've been focusing on this afternoon is the last Santa Cruz City Council meeting. Every two Tuesdays, every other Tuesday, actually, there is a meeting of the Santa Cruz City Council, generally, in which they do their business, sort of pretending to do the business of the public. That's the way I view it. And you can see this really most clearly when issues come up in which a large segment or a significant segment of the population disagrees with what their staff and city manager behind closed doors and their police department decide is best for the rest of us. Most recently, this has been the Bearcat, the armored personnel carrier, which the police department improperly describes as a rescue vehicle, and which the manufacturers describe otherwise, essentially as a vehicle that has numerous uses. I mean, I suppose it could be used for rescue in some circumstances, but according to the testimony that was presented at length at City Council, it's not generally used for those purposes. It's more of an attack vehicle than a defense vehicle. Well, it is an armored personnel carrier, so it does defend those people inside it. Anyway, it's not sort of my major issue, but a lot of people got really upset both because of the fact that police departments throughout the country are treating black people, minorities, and poor people like shit and shooting them down somewhat shamelessly and then just sort of ignoring the consequences. And in Santa Cruz, we don't have shooting so much as we have just abusive and discriminatory behavior by the department. And when complaints are made, they're ignored around these issues. At least that's what I've found through looking at the public records, and we'll hopefully be giving you more information on that as we proceed. Still haven't gotten the records crunched for Officer Azua, but there looks like we've got someone back on, not on the payroll, we don't pay nothing, but at least interested, who has done some quick and intense work on crunching public records stats. That's Raven Davis, who may be calling into the show tonight and did speak at the Tuesday City Council meeting. So the Bearcat is this armored personnel vehicle that the police department rushed in on December 9th to say, you got to get this immediately, okay, this grant, although it doesn't cost the city any. It does involve some $250,000 or so, which somebody's paying for and is going, you know, to military contractors eventually to replace all this equipment that's being strewn around the country by Homeland Security. And the city council said, oh, sure, sounds fine to us, including Mayor Don Lane. And as far as I could see, they couldn't even give a clear deadline for when they needed to have this decision by, but they fudged it, suggesting that it had to be done immediately. But they'd sat on it for 7 months. So you would have thought that, as there was consequence, many people were upset. A lot of organizations who I haven't heard much from recently, Resource Center for Nonviolence, other groups like Sinbaras, Santa Cruz Community Coalition to Combat Racism, HUF, my group, the group I work with, Homeless United for Friendship and Freedom, a whole bunch of groups, showed up at City Council in great numbers and actually let City Council know they wanted this Bearcat issue reversed. They didn't want a military vehicle in Santa Cruz. Now, as I was going to say a moment ago, this is not my top priority. I'm more concerned with how the police are treating poor people, destroying tents, stealing property, treating people abusively, citing them, impoverishing them, immiserating them, humiliating them. And what is largely a system, admittedly, of humiliation. The police aren't kind of making these choices as individual human beings. They're simply following a script. But the fact is, they're following the script. And it has the same impact as if they were making those choices, you know, as individual private citizens. So I don't, you know, buy the argument. Oh, you know, there's good police officers underneath there. All you have to do is appeal to their hearts. Now, unfortunately, police officers, though, I'm sure they have hearts. They do. We all have hearts. They earn wages. They are in it to do a job and make money, and also because they believe to some extent, or at least they act as though they believe, in the ideology that the department supports, which is, if you read it in the book, it's the broken windows ideology, which is you don't want poor people hanging around because it'll create more crime. It's like a broken window. That's the theory. Former Chief Steve Belcher, that was his name, in the 90s, put it into the book. I think he put it in there. At least it was there under his police chieftainship, when he was the chief. Might have been there when Jack Bassett was chief before him, and it certainly was there when Howard Scarry and now Chief Kevin Vogel came after. So the real concern I have is, you know, use of force by the police, accountability, transparency, the willingness of the police to have meaningful public input into their policies, to have violent cops dismissed and prosecuted if necessary, to have bigoted cops face similar consequences when they are using their office to abuse other individuals. The trouble is when the system itself becomes intrinsically abusive, then they're just following orders, you see. But still, they're guilty. The system is guilty for sure, but so are individual officers. Anyway, what does that have to do with the Bearcat? Well, you know, the Bearcat is a kind of a dramatic indication of the very visible militarization of stuff in Santa Cruz. And that pissed off a lot of people, particularly when it was done behind closed doors. And almost, one suspects, in a somewhat mendacious, that's a fancy word for lying, kind of way. And again, there's no smoking gun. I don't have the memos that show they said, hey, let's sneak this past the community by putting it on the last agenda of the year and saying, hey, we got to do it right now. Even though we don't have a clear deadline date that we can point to in any of the documents, which, for example, I've seen. But, you know, I'm not an expert in reading all these grant documents, but I have not seen any indication that you have to have done this by December 31st, 2014, which is the claim of Deputy Chief Steve Clark. You know, I'm open to being corrected in that. But there was no such information provided at the last city council meeting, which was on January 13th. Now, you would have thought that Mayor Don Lane, who professes to be a liberal, he makes liberal gestures, like saying, inviting the activists concerned about the Bearcat acquisition who want to get rid of it, and also want to see other changes, want to stop the criminalization of homeless people that is really like a fucking runaway train in Santa Cruz. And he makes these liberal pretensions, statements. You know, he's a big fan of the Homeless Lack of Services Center, as I call the Homeless Services Center. You know, he was on the board of directors. He may be again. He's, you know, he has a lot of heart-rending rhetoric about the homeless. I think he was the only council member to show up at the homeless memorial this year. I could be wrong about that. I know he did show up. I did not. I believe it's a kind of a phony deal, although I remember some of the people who died. Baltimore. And so you would have thought that what Lane would have done is, well, there seems to be, you know, a couple hundred people coming to city council who want to talk about this issue. So let's put it on the agenda. You know, the city council may decide to snub these people, may get the police department to, you know, reassure the community that it's gotten some misinformation, or that it, even whatever information it's got, the Bearcat is still a worthy project. And there could be some back and forth. There could be some real discussion, some dialogue, some new information uncovered. Lane did no such thing. He did not put it on the agenda, though he had the complete option to do so. The mayor sets the agenda. Instead, he let it drift to the oral communications period of the meeting. And he attempted to head off protests because he knew, because on December 9th, at the last council meeting of the year, people were so angry that they stood up and started shouting, shame, shame, and disrupted the council meeting. Yes, they did. They really did disrupt the council meeting. I know that's shocking to someone. I've often said I don't disrupt council meetings. City Council accuses me of doing this, but I don't. And pretty generally, I don't. And I've been a part of some actions, in, I think one in San Jose 12 years ago, where the city council was disrupted in a nonviolent way by a whole bunch of people, and I was one of them. And I've been present when other disruptions have happened. I've been accused repeatedly of disruption, but I try to walk a very, very careful line. Probably not the best idea as I look back over my life. More disruptions might have been a very good idea. Because if you disrupt an unjust process, you're doing a good thing. If you disrupt people who are lying and putting things over on the community that they shouldn't be putting over, you're doing a good thing. You're not doing a bad thing. I know it. There are going to be all kinds of arguments. Well, if you disrupt, then everyone will disrupt. It'll be chaotic. It'll be violent. The real question, though, is the process that is being disrupted so intrinsically and habitually violent that it needs to be disrupted? And usually people who are disruptive are not violent. They're just loud. And they're raising voices that have been suppressed in previous councils or at that particular current council. Or they're so upset by what's happened. And you might say, oh, they're just emotional. That's, you've got to be reasonable and calm and quiet and talk about it in mellow tones. Depends. You know, I mean, first of all, it's a healthy and natural response to be angry at injustice. You can fly off the handle prematurely on misinformation. You can be kind of let off in the boonies by, you know, crowd hysteria or something. I mean, I accuse Take Back Santa Cruz of engaging in what I call needle mania, needle hysteria. I see speaker after speaker repeating the same line about blood and feces in the restrooms in the parks, and this is the reason why you want to pass laws that make people stay away from the parks for weeks and months and years because they're sleeping at night there. That has nothing to do with those issues. You know, it's not just peculiar. It is. It's a form of groupthink, which is simply, it's promulgating false information and it's acting on false information. So that can happen to different groups. I'm not saying it can't happen to groups of people who are, you know, misled about what kind of weapons the police force is acquiring. Could happen, for sure. In this case, I don't think it is. And I think what's really happening here is the city manager and the police department are going behind the back of the community. And you might say, why are they a bunch of sneaky villains? No, they're just doing business as usual. This is how business is conducted in Santa Cruz. They don't involve the public. You know, every 2 years there's a slight change in the face of the city council. But the underlying structure underneath, the city manager, the head of the police department, the city attorney, the head of parks and rec, the heads of all the other departments who get 200 G's or more a year, and pensions to boot, and benefits, never changes. It's always the same. Unless these people die or, you know, migrate to better jobs. There's no accountability for these folks. They have the power. And so the city council members, even the most ones who claim to be the most liberal, like Micah Posner, will say, well, we have to really, you know, work with the staff. And he's constantly giving us all these wonderful comments about how, you know, at least how wonderful the staff is. And when the staff requests something, the staff has to be respected, and the staff gets huge amounts of time to push its propaganda for its proposals. And the public gets 2 minutes, if it gets that at all. They've arranged the consent agenda, as I've often talked about, the agenda that covers more than half of the city council's stuff, so that you can't really talk on it at all. And I have a caller. Sorry, I haven't been looking closely. Here we go, caller. Hey there, you're on Free Radio.
Oh, hi.
Hi. You got to turn down your radio, otherwise you are going to be very confused.
Got it.
There you go.
Hey, Robert.
Hey.
I just tuned in, so I don't know if these points have been made yet, but about the Bearcat, I was watching the news broadcast of the city council charade, and I just wanted to make a couple points in response to what the news broadcast said.
Uh-huh.
One of which is that they had to push it through because the city was afraid that it would not, get it if they didn't vote on it right away. There was this time limit. And one of the things that came out, even though there was luckily this great PowerPoint presentation, visual because we had no audio, is that the police have been working on this and sitting on this for 7 months.
Right. Yeah. Actually, so you probably haven't been listening to my show, right? Or have you?
No, I just tuned in. So maybe for people who just tuned in, you know, because the other thing is they're saying it's a done deal. It's not a done deal. They can turn it. They can give it back. Berkeley gave theirs back. San Jose gave theirs back. The cops and the city council are using the example of our two fallen officers from last year as if that would have done anything for them. That Bearcat would have done nothing for that situation. That thing couldn't have even gotten in to where they were shot, you know. And they had no expectation that they were going to be shot. So,
you know, all this is true, caller. I mean, there's no question about it. See, but for me, there's a deeper issue here. I mean, you're making reasonable arguments, as people did for an hour and 15 minutes on Tuesday. Person after person made one reasonable argument after another, and then they all they all filed off and went home. But the same thing happened. That is to say, nothing changed. And so the issue for me is, how does the public really express itself in the democratic will in the way that they need to? And what do we need to do to make sure we can restore a democratic process? Reasonable arguments apparently don't do the trick. See, that's the problem.
Because they're not listening. And also, I have no idea what those reasonable arguments were, because apparently a well-working sound system is beyond their capability.
Well, that's another irony, you know, caller, because at the same meeting, they made it a excludable and arguably an arrestable offense to record your own, make your own recording, unless you're sitting next to your recorder while doing it. And also, you can't do it from a position close to the speaker's lectern. At least they were making that clear.
Yeah, so this is pretty nitpicky to me, I think, given that, say, back to the Bearcat issue, the cops have no accountability for whether they use this thing inappropriately. There's no penalty, is there, or accountability on their point? And as far as decorum goes, or where you put your tape recorder, what about the city council decorum? You know, they used up oral communications time, which you just said, you know, is our only chance to speak, as if it does any good, which apparently it doesn't. You know, for us to listen to this policeman give us no, basically, I didn't hear anything that made me feel any better. You know, they'll ask a manager first, apparently, before they use it. But there's no accountability of, you know, whether the manager... this whole thing is weird. So anyway, I'll get off, because I just tuned in. So
feel free to
the conversation.
Yeah, I mean, I think we probably share a lot of the same views here. I mean, you know, I know you personally, and I also, you know, I mean, I don't disagree with what you said.
So one last thing is that I feel like, back to the 7 months, they really need to not reward the cops for that kind of strategy. It's not okay to sit on it for 7 months and then rush it through.
One of the problems with your whole argument, you're using the wrong pronouns. They really need to, they're going to do whatever they fucking want. They're going to ignore.
That's the problem with
they're going to ignore everything you're saying. And the only thing time is going to change is if there's a we that becomes a part of this whole process. So for instance, the 7 month issue, you and I would not have known about, except that John Malkin and I and a few others put in Public Records Act requests. It didn't come out thanks to Don Lane. It didn't come out thanks to Chief Kevin Vogel. It came out thanks to citizens who took those issues. And the fact that, you know, the same people who were either disinterested in this information or actively interested in concealing it, you're going to go to those same people and ask them to be reasonable about this issue and be fair. I mean, it is unrealistic for you to do that. See, it's the wrong, it doesn't make any sense. It's like, you know, the idea of the insane person, the person does the same thing over and over again, hoping for a different result.
Yeah, you know? Because really it should make sense, but it clearly doesn't. It, you know, at this point they've made it pretty clear they're not listening, they're going to do what they want. regardless of public opinion, which public opinion is pretty clear.
It's not they've got that information,
yeah, I mean, I think, because there's also, I'm guessing, been petitions and whatnot.
Yeah, I mean, it's not just this issue. I mean, this is their standard process. See, that's something that people who are not familiar with the city council, I think, aren't really aware of, that, you know, unless you're part of a small elite group that has access to the city council's ears, look at the last city council meetings for the last 2 years. Try to think of one time that even overwhelming public opinion that came into the council and spoke at oral communications has actually been able to change in any meaningful way the council's behavior. There's probably, you know, some minor changes that have happened. But there is no process.
Well, Robert.
Wait a minute. There's no process that actually allows the public before the city council meetings to be a part of that process so they can actually join in the formation of these done deals that then come up before us, which then the council votes through after they get to, you know, they sit there nodding and looking at the community and saying, see, we're looking at you. We're not reading a newspaper like the city attorney. See how attentive we are. And everybody goes, oh, I guess that's okay because that's how it's supposed to be. I'm sorry, you were going to say something.
Yeah, no, this is great. Although they usually are looking at their laptops, but yeah. So my question to you is, where's our power?
The power is in the people. People and the power, and the power of the people don't stop. Hey, what? If you know what I mean.
So we need more people to show up to, and we need more people doing background stuff like you guys get.
Not really. That's not bad. But again, you see, the focus cannot be on persuading the city council. The focus has to be on demanding that certain things be done and enlisting the community behind you and finding the ways to do that, which are going to be, as of yet, they are not yet created. See, that's it. We don't have those organs of power that have been created. I mean, an obvious thing to have done, for example, now as I look at it, and I just thought about this today, when the Don Lane, after cutting off the last 10 speakers in oral communication, he said, look at how wonderful I am. You know, he didn't say this, but he was saying, you know, he gave, instead of a half an hour's oral communication, which is what Lynn Robinson usually does, he gave an hour and then extended it to an hour and 15 minutes. Oh, how wonderful. No, it's not. He should have made a public hearing out of this issue because of the intensity of the interest, if he was really interested. He should have had open meetings before the council so people could meet in subcommittee with, the police chief, with, I don't know, LEMCO executives, with experts on demilitarizing and militarizing, and see, you know, if this is what we want. He wasn't interested in any of that stuff. He was looking to cool down the situation. He did not want to see another disruption, such as was a very unusual December 9th disruption at the city council, which happened the prior meeting, where people had enough. They stopped the meeting shouting, shame, shame, shame. That came because of a variety of factors. They tried not only to ram through the Bearcat, they also tried to tell people how they should stand when they talked at the microphone. You know, that was a little too much for some people. It certainly was too much for me. I couldn't take that kind of stuff. And I know, people were pissed enough to start taking an independent course. You often have to find the independent course as you go because it's unknown territory. They want to channel you into existing channels of they want to, what's called, you know, manufacture consent, as Noam Chomsky would put it. They want to create, you follow the same ruts you always do and, oh, just wait for another election, you know, get together 4,000 signatures for an initiative, call your congressman, write a letter to the Sentinel. And if that's all you're going to do, you're stuck. There's nothing else that's going to happen. Yeah. They're not going to change. The power structure remains intact. That's the problem. And what we could have done, for instance, I'm thinking, is the minute that Lane did his thing, well, we've all given you, first we gave you 2 minutes, now we'll give you 1 minute, and now we'll cut off the last 10 speakers, and then we'll give the police chief, I don't know, 10 minutes to give his little response, which he and Lane conferred on before the whole meeting. What we could have done was we could have said, someone could have stand up and say, this is a farce. We're going outside. The community is going to discuss this all outside and come to some conclusions about what needs to be done to make some changes here. Because if we try it inside, they'll start pulling these guys in blue uniforms with batons and gudges, you know, and guns and badges and bear cats, and they'll do whatever they are authorized to do to intimidate us or screw with us. So we'll go outside and we'll make some choices of our own. We'll come to some new decisions about what we're going to do. But see, people aren't really ready to do that because we are very well conditioned to believe, you know, there are these certain approaches we have to use. And you know, some people express rage, like Steve Argue stood up and said, you know, fuck this shit, he said. And, you know, people said,
yeah, you know, I was a little...
And people like yourself... embarrassed to hear that.
I was embarrassed about that, though. I went home and went, oh, my God, I just made a fool of myself in front of all these people. But I felt a little mama bear about it when they swooped in on him so fast, you know, that I thought if I started speaking up, they'd kind of have to get distracted and show that they were discriminating.
Well, I think that was a very protective thing to do. But I think more important is... I was also, oh, no, there's Steve, he's going off, there are people going to think that's going to ruin the issue, you know. All these these conventional fears ignored the fact that he is speaking the truth. This is bullshit. This is a fucking nonsense. And he was saying with anger and passion and determination what, in a way, we all should have been saying. In fact, some people were whispering to me, let's say shame.
Well, I was kind of hoping people would go back to the shame chanting or something because the meeting was clearly wrapping up and we weren't getting anywhere. I mean, Don Lane should have just said from the very beginning, listen, we're going to listen to you guys for an hour and a half and then we're not going to do anything about, you know, you can speak, but we won't listen. And you've got an hour and a half.
And, of course, what they like to do in these situations also is they'll say to you, well, this is oral communications. We can't do anything during oral communications. It's not on the agenda. And that, in fact, is what Lane said to the Sentinel. And the Sentinel reporter said, well, you're going to, you know, rescind the Bearcat? And why won't you, will you be discussing that? And it says, no. I said, why not? I said, oh, because it's not on the agenda. Of course,
put it on the fucking agenda.
Exactly.
Excuse me. Oh, I can cuss. It's free radio. Well, hey, I'm on my cell phone. I got to save some minutes. So can I let you keep going and listen?
Sure. No problem.
All right. Thank you, Robert.
Thank you, caller. Yeah, I mean, Don Lane sets the agenda. So it's completely disingenuous to say, it isn't on the agenda is the reason we can't talk about it. It's also not true. Even if something isn't on the agenda, the claim that, oh, it's happening during oral communication, which is the period of time that they've set off in this doghouse segment at 5 o'clock, when the community is either just coming back from work and, you know, everybody else has gone home out of the city council, and the main issues of the evening at 7 o'clock, which is where oral communication used to be, haven't even arrived. But, you know, the council often members say, I'll refer to that. And the council members, if they want, can call people from the audience and ask questions and make comments. And they can even ask for staff reports. You can't pass, it's true, an agenda item with, theoretically, although I think they've done this too in the past, although I've got to review the record to be accurate about this, without putting it, you know, giving advance notice to the community, which of course is farcical, because even if they give advance notice to the community, that doesn't mean anything if they're not going to pay any attention to what the community says or does. That's the problem with this farce of a democratic process. And I don't think, you know, this is the irony, and I was talking to another activist about this earlier. The irony here is I don't think that even the council members, even Don Lane, who is the mayor, who is doing all this, and, you know, I'm holding him accountable. He's not innocent of this stuff. But I don't think he is really he's not intentionally trying to be undemocratic. This is what he thinks democracy looks like. I mean, it's ridiculous. It's not democracy. But he has been, you know, as a person in power, in and out of power, he's been mayor a number of times. He's been in council a number of times. He's been part of the favored circle of council members throughout his life, the last 20 years in Santa Cruz. he believes this is what it is. This democracy is, you know, going through this oral communications process, and he feels he's being very generous by giving more oral communications time, by chatting with members of the opposition to the Bearcat before the meeting, even though he then talks to the police chief and comes to decisions about letting the police chief declare a policy for keeping the Bearcat and how they're going to use the Bearcat, having decided they're going to keep the Bearcat. Though that is the reason that several hundred people, or at least 130, came to the city council. At least many of them did for that reason. And so the obvious thing to do is to put it on the agenda again. But I think, you know, I haven't asked him the question, why didn't you do that? Frankly, because I had long discussions with him over the weekend about, why is he going to stop me from putting a tape recorder near the mic, which I did yesterday again, as did three other people, because his sound system went off, and for about at least half an hour or more, there was no sound on the TV. People couldn't hear the oral communication. It's a very differential standard here. I mean, it's ridiculous. And we're all supposed to act with great respect for this process. The one positive thing I will say about Lane, although it's more a form of his, I think, trying to manage the crowd, is he doesn't use the approach that you can see most typified by Cynthia Matthews, Lynn Robinson, and in very, very dramatically, and that kind of, and sadly, by Police Chief Kevin Vogel. If you were watching or listening to the meeting, on Tuesday, and you heard Vogel speak. We spoke after everyone else spoke up at the Bearcat. It wasn't a Bearcat issue. It was oral communications, where everybody else in oral communication was largely sidelined out because there were a lot of people who wanted to talk about the Bearcat, and Lane refused to set up a special Bearcat issue or hearing, which is what he needed to do. Although that would have been another control measure. I'm pretty sure he wasn't. You know, if he was really interested, he would have said, you know, he would have essentially called Chief Vogel and said, why did you delay this issue for 7 months? You're fired, or you're suspended, or let's have a hearing about this bullshit. Why are you doing this? You know, hold him accountable. He didn't do that. He'd piss in his pants before he'd do such a thing. I think Lane's a nice guy, or at least he gives the impression of being a nice guy a lot. That's his sort of his persona, and I think it runs pretty deep. But he isn't interested in challenging this power structure, and that's why this power structure will continue until enough of the community decides they've had enough of this stuff. And one thing that was very encouraging about the whole Bearcat issue, or the whole issue of people coming to that, it's too bad that, you know, I mean, I keep thinking, why don't they go after discrimination against the poor by the police, force by the police, behind the scenes dealings by the police department, lack of transparency and accountability in Santa Cruz, except this one issue, the Bearcat. But if it leads in that direction, I'm happy. I mean, I don't think it's going to matter to homeless people whether they get a Bearcat or not. You know, what's going to matter is whether the police are going to stop ripping up their tents and tearing up their property and confiscating it and only making it available when they've confiscated it 4 hours a week between the times 12:30 to 2:30 every Tuesday and Thursday, which is their current abusive process. And they know it's abusive. They've been doing it for years. It's really disgusting. You know, you wonder why people started guillotining aristocrats in the French Revolution is because the same kind of habitual obliviousness to basic human needs and feelings was happening there. And it happens wherever power structures become entrenched. I mean, I'm becoming more and more convinced of that fact. I'm still thinking about all this stuff. So, I've got no really final conclusions. Anyway, those are some of the thoughts I have. I encourage you to call in 427-3772. I really will try to give you a chance to say what you want to say. I've been, you know, eager to get my point of view out, and I certainly have gotten some of it out. I want to know what you thought about it. By the way, some people did say on the streets yesterday, oh, you know, they turned on the microphones only when or the sound came on only when the police chief, Chief Kevin Vogel, was speaking. Actually, I don't know if that was true at the time, but if you go to the video, which has now appeared, you can now see and hear at least some of the video of the Santa Cruz City Council meeting of the day before yesterday, the one we're talking about. The sound is only off for somewhere between 15 minutes and 45 minutes, and then it comes on again significantly before the police chief's final statements. And I'm going to try to play the police chief's final statements, and I'll deconstruct them for you, or at least I'll give you my thoughts on them, too, in a bit. But it isn't true that there was a clear, oh, we'll shut off all the public from speaking and, you know, only turn everything on when the police chief gets up there to speak. That wasn't the case. But it's really as if that was the case, because no matter what you say, it wasn't taken into account except, oh, we're very glad to have heard what you said, and we're going to think about all this stuff. And I think Lane probably thought that he was doing everybody a favor by having the police chief talk and say, you know, he was thinking of what happened at the prior meeting when there was a motion that failed to say, don't use this armored personnel vehicle against protesters, peaceful protesters. And the police department, apparently, it didn't seem like it would agree to that, and the council would not direct them to do that, although they said, well, we don't think we will, unless it looks like it's necessary to do that. And so Lane maybe wanted to reassure the public that they were going to take that into consideration, everything was going to be okay. This is the standard, you know, what we call recuperative kind of way to encourage people to feel better after they've been, you know, whacked in the face with this whole thing, than to say, oh, but it's okay. See, it's really, let's not look at it too harsh. It's going to, here, you know, here's some treats for you. See, here's the police chief. He'll talk to you all about all this. And so you can talk to me behind closed doors too. And you can have an hour and 15 minutes to talk, you know, gosh, what about that? You know, aren't we nice? Anyway, it's a bogus process, as I've said. And let's take a musical break while I unwind a little and think about giving a call in if you'd like, 427-3772. And maybe I'll turn to something else, too, because the main points have been made. I may also play what the police chief said. And I am going to attempt to, at least on Sunday, play a significant part of that part that was not allowed, not that again, that's improper, badly put. It was, I think it was because of genuine mechanical problems with their speaker system that we were not able to hear some of the oral communication. But the point was, if we had followed their orders and not put out our machines in a way that they had specifically earlier in the meeting told us would be a violation of their decorum rules. Unattended recorder, which means it has to be right next to you. And we just, myself and several other people, including a major news media, just put our machine, our microphones right up there close to the microphone so they could hear people. And for the first time in a year, Sergeant Bush did not come in and try to grab my machine. Now, maybe he was advised by Don Lane, well, because our speaker system isn't working, we'll let them make their own recording this time. But there's a real good reason why people want to make their own recordings, not just because the speaker system may fail. It is because, in the abstract, it has to be a right of everyone to do that, and it is under California law and under the constitutions of at least the United States, I think California as well. But also, those mics get turned off at the discretion of the chair. So if they want to turn it off because they don't like what someone's saying for one reason or another, maybe it violates decorum or something else is happening, then you're not going to hear what's being said unless somebody else is recording. It's really very simple. So for Lane to push for new decorum rules, which he successfully did at this meeting, and that's another thing which I think I'll be playing some audio on probably this Sunday, he was able to pass a rule that said you can only place your little machine over there in the side wall. It's right next to the window that kind of faces toward the university. That's the only way I can think of it. And if you otherwise you leave it anywhere else in the room and you walk away from it, that disrupts the council meeting. Clearly preposterous. And then in order to get past the preposterousness of it, he says he added a new rule that said, well, a disruption doesn't mean a disruption. It means if the council decides you're violating a rule and tells you not to violate the rule and has to stop the meeting to tell you that again, then you are disrupting the meeting. A redefinition of disruption. I've written about this for those who are interested in Santa Cruz Indie Media, indiebay.org/Santa Cruz, indiebay.org/Santa Cruz. So, let's go musical, and I'll be right back. That's an unfortunately rather poor recording. Songs to the Sea by Homie G. I'm not quite sure I got that. A lot of the stuff I get from the streets I like. Some of it I don't. And it's a little so I'm going to leave that one off to the side for the moment. I am going to play now a bit from the beginning of the oral communications period of the last Santa Cruz City Council meeting. And that was the... began with a presentation, a PowerPoint presentation by John Malkin, who has written articles about the Bearcat for the Good Times and probably elsewhere. And he's also made Public Records Act requests to find out, in essence, that not only did the police department know about this acquisition in May, but Representative Farr and other public officials knew about it the previous year that it was being sought for. Actually, he got that from records that I was able to get out of a couple of days before the city council meeting. And I'm always kind of giving these records only a very kind of superficial looking over, and hopefully I'm hoping others can look at them more deeply like John did. This is not the best recording because the sound system was going ape, and I was half my eye was on the machine, half of it was on a Sergeant Bush. Wasn't sure if he was going to come over and take the recorder. I don't know if I was going to let him take the recorder. I was thinking of standing up and just standing in the way of the recorder and say, "Sergeant, a reporter, if you want to take my recorder, take me first." Yeah, I know it has a nice sound to it, and it's not something that I'm comfortable doing, and it's nice to the bravado afterward, but I'll see what I do at the next city council meeting if I get to it, if I want to waste my time in those chambers. The one thing that was not a waste of time was the fact that so many people came together and showed that it isn't just Take Back Santa Cruz, which had its legions there too. And Alicia Cube was there for the evening to make the false claims that she has no problem with people who are sleeping. She only wants to rid the parks of blood and feces and needles and crazy behavior and in the bathrooms that threaten the children. That's the argument of the trouble is it has nothing to do with the legislation she's supporting, which has been used over the last year, creating stay away orders that have gone after largely homeless people and have been for nonviolent behavior. Sleeping, being in a park after dark, smoking, violating, again, like the city council, violating the rules. They're trying to get people to behave and live in a certain way. It's one thing, and not a very good thing, an unconstitutional thing in my view, to do it in a council chamber where people, you know, they can leave the council chamber and walk outside, but it's still their right to be there, and it's wrong to impose those standards on people unless there's, you know, a meeting is really being improperly disrupted, and there's a whole argument about when it really should be disrupted, and that's another issue, but calling things that are not disruptions, disruptions in order to intimidate people, shut them down, frighten them, and control them, and essentially rein in their speech and their behavior is wrong and strikes at the heart of democracy, when particularly when it's done in legislative chambers, because that's where people come to get their opinions heard and hopefully implemented. But when you go after people's survival, when you seek them out in the forests, when you seek them, exclude them from the parks, when you criminalize them as, you know, menaces to children, you start doing this kind of nasty, essentially proto-Nazi shit. It is really along those lines. I know that makes people upset when they, I'm not a Nazi, you know, says the half dozen or dozen people who spoke on behalf of the let's make it not just illegal to sleep in the park, but let's make sure that if you do, you'll face a year in jail if you go back to the park later for any reason, once you've gotten an infraction, even before you go to court to see if that infraction was properly given. Yes, that's the law in Santa Cruz. In a month, that's what will be enforced. It was passed on Tuesday night. In fact, I probably should read it, you know, in some, at its length, so people can actually hear what this law is. Because I think a number of people just don't even know what this ordinance says. And but this is, I will read it. But in any case, I think people tend to, they tend to delude themselves that they want to see something done about their feeling of anxiety and insecurity about seeing things that shouldn't be there. There shouldn't be shit in the bathrooms on the floor. No, there shouldn't be. And there shouldn't be, you know, people shooting up with needles. No, there shouldn't be. There should be some inhalation and injection centers where people go do that. But there's this crazy prohibition mentality that is, you know, still stalking the country. And it's part of some, it's almost a religion with some people. And so what they want to do is instead, they want to, I think that a lot of the anxiety also comes from economic anxiety. People are anxious about their jobs. They think, you know, I've worked real hard and I've got a little house and now there's a fucking needle in my neighborhood and I don't feel my kids are safe. Who's that homeless person over there? Did they take my bike from the backyard? You know, these become the focus instead of the more basic issues of why are you have to work at two shit jobs and deal with a, you know, a corrupt banking system that may take your house, you know, a week after tomorrow because they did that 4 or 5 years ago. Why not again as the situation gets worse and the government steals your money to create more terrorists overseas? Instead of, you know, trying to get together to really address these issues, people want to go after, you know, the evil stranger in our midst. I mean, I know, that's sort of an old cliched notion. I don't know exactly if it fits this situation, but it's worth thinking about. Let's hear now from the city council meeting of January 13th. This is the reason I'm playing this is I believe this sound was cut off pretty quickly after this, and some people may never, who weren't at the meeting, may not have heard this, although I suspect many people listening to this show did get to the meeting, so I hope that it's not merely repetitious for you. Maybe.
Can't hear you.
You weren't notified about this for 7 months until December 2nd. On December 9th, police representatives told you that the grant would disappear if
John
you didn't
Malcolm.
Vote on it that night. please rescind the grant approval and organize a public study session about this grant and the Bearcat and the process by which grants come to City Council and come to the Santa Cruz Police. Also, please implement a procedure that used to exist for Santa Cruz that requires police to notify the City Council and the public before they apply for grants. Thank you very much. You'll hear more details.
Thank you.
Abby Samuels is presenting a PowerPoint presentation. And the chambers were packed.
And thank you.
There she goes.
I'm here to thank you, Don, for inviting me to represent a coalition of eight of us. We convened right after the December 9th meeting. First of all, I wanted to find out if all of you knew what Bearcat stood for, which is Ballistic Engineered Armored Response Counterattack Truck. Does this work? No. So basically, this presentation is based on a collaboration from several different groups, from people from the ACLU, people from Women's International for Peace and Freedom, the People's Democratic Club. We had a first responder, people from Food Not Bombs and Code Pink and civil rights activists. I'm trying to make a 5-minute, hour presentation into 5 minutes, so I'm going to do this really fast. Whoops. So there's two core points I wanted to mention, is the reasons why the Bearcat order should be rescinded and a proposal to change the process. First reason is perception. What does it look like in our streets when we have military vehicles on our streets? And even if it is used as a rescue vehicle, it impacts the way people react to the police. It's as though we are treated like enemies. And also, reason two is that the policing is becoming dictated by Department of Homeland Security's notion of combating terrorism. In fact, the grant is from the UASI, which stands for Urban Areas Security Initiative, which is urban zones that are determined as risk for terrorist activities. So it is stated, yesterday we just received a whole bunch of documents that we got from not Freedom of Information Act, but from the other
Public Records Act.
Thanks, Don. And it states in there that basically this is an anti-terrorism vehicle. There's nowhere that it mentions that. This is going on its own without me clicking. There's nothing on there that mentions it's a rescue vehicle. The application for the grant that we did receive states that it's being used as a SWAT team vehicle. And SWAT teams are not necessarily for the rescue situations that we envision. I'm not going to go through every single point. Also, the current usage throughout the country, it's not used as a rescue vehicle. It's being used for drug busts, serving warrants, and peaceful protests. Nearly 80% of the SWAT raids the ACU studied were to serve search warrants, usually for drug cases. And also, they determined, the ACLU, that the taxes and tactics and equipment often increase the risk of property damage and bodily harm. Most importantly, why did the police not agree to an amendment that stated that this vehicle would not be used for peaceful protests? They also stated that they had entertained the idea of borrowing a Bearcat for Occupy, so it is on their mind. Then another reason is, why don't we get a different vehicle that's not a military vehicle, instead of where all the holes are for guns and the turret for a machine gun? Can't we get a bulletproof vehicle like bank vehicles? And we have precedents from Berkeley. They return their vehicle. And I believe that the underlying problem is not a police equipment one. It's a mental health issue. There's more emphasis on community policing, not military policing. A city that focuses on health and happiness will have less crime. Instead, they're focusing on fear. And military vehicles will only add to the aggression of the society. That's not what we need. The current process, and what I want to discuss is what John just actually spoke about. Fall of 2013, we applied for the grant. Grants are processed by Deputy Chief Steve Clark. May 14th, it was approved by Homeland Security via telephone. And then sometime between that time, the city manager was notified by police via telephone, no paper trail. Then December 2nd, the city council first heard about it, was put on the consent agenda as a rescue vehicle, and the city council voted to approve it after the police department said that postponing it would result in the loss of funds. So why did they wait 7 months, allowed them to make the argument that postponement would result in the loss of funds? We can't even find a date of this March date if it's not used. We looked through all of the documents. We can't even find that. So I'm not even sure if that's true. So I'd like to see that document where we had to wait till March. So why did they wait to give public's notice? Inadequacy of public discussion. No one addressed our concerns until after the vote. It was put on the consent agenda, and these are our suggestions for a new process. Grants over a certain amount must go to the city council and a public hearing and have it on the regular agenda in the evening. And then we also suggest to use the ACLU's model surveillance and community safety ordinance. And the last thing is, why isn't it on the website? And a lot of us can answer your questions that are here, not just myself. Thank you very much.
That was Abby Samuels speaking for 5 minutes and not able to finish her presentation. Again, this is something that should have been presented as a public hearing where she would have had even more time to speak, at least to present it as a presenter, and presumably there would have maybe been able to have other more expert witnesses come in and talk about this. And maybe the police chief then could have responded with, we have these following requirements and so forth. And then, of course, the public should have been allowed to put questions to the police chief. Yes, I know, that's unconventional, though that's the problem. It needs to be conventional, that the staff is required to not just take questions from a compliant and subservient city council that is concerned with every other sentence and telling the staff what a wonderful job they're doing, but needs to be from members of the critical public. And not filtered through council members who worry about not being able to get what they want from the staff if they are a little too sharp in their questioning. It's really sort of rolls my stomach over. Well, it makes me wince and pisses me off when I hear every second or third sentence. That's an exaggeration, but it certainly happens frequently. Micah Posner does this, thanking the staff for their wonderful good work and so forth endlessly. When in fact, we have to blame the staff for this. And yes, we blame the mayor as well, and we blame the city council members. But it's the staff that keeps doing this, and the staff that needs to be held to account. And that's why another suggestion I have for protest here is to go to the offices of the staff and make demands. And do your protest there. Don't just go to city council, wave a few signs, and so forth. But go to the staff and camp outside their offices, and go to individual council members and camp outside their offices. That's something that we Huff members talked about yesterday. We're going to be having a meeting, by the way, to decide on next steps in a protest. That'll be coming up on Saturday, day after tomorrow, about an hour before the Food Not Bombs meal. It's at 3:30 thereabouts at the main post office. Let's hear some more of the city council meeting.
I suspected, and has now come true, that our fire marshal is here. This room is really unsafe.
This is Mayor Donnelly saying that the room is too packed, and have to clear the aisles, people have to go outside. I wasn't clear on how many people were outside. If anybody knows how many people were outside, I know there were about 100 and some odd people inside, and the question is, I heard that there were lots of people outside too. I'd like to get a real accurate estimate of how many folks came to that meeting. If anybody knows, call in 427-3772. And there's a...
No one can hear you to the microphone.
unfair audio.
And there was some concern because people outside couldn't hear, which was also the case on December 9th.
When maybe open that other window, too.
It wasn't that the chambers were too crowded before on December 9th. It was rather that the council locked the doors and couldn't get in.
The speakers outside, they're so faint, even if you had were the only person out there, you're up.
This is Keith McHenry saying the speakers outside are too faint to hear.
That needs to be repaired. If there's a public works department person, we just
so are. Is there anyone outside who is
that's
hearing
Don Lane.
Yeah. There's 100 people out here.
100 people out here, they cannot hear.
There's a claim right there that there are 100 people
list.
Outside.
Just call the list. I'll leave as soon as you call me. I was number 4. You can't require disabled people to stand in line.
This is Mike Boyd. You've come to the mic. He was one of the oral communications people. Wanted to speak at oral communications. And as I mentioned before, Don Lane's process in not making this a separate agenda item severely disadvantaged those people who wanted to use the oral communications period, which is what it's supposed to be used for, which is items not on the agenda, which usually is almost everything that's important, strangely enough. Anyway, let's hear a little bit more of this, and then we'll proceed to even more exciting activity.
Here, because of the sound system, let's do our part to just be as quiet as we can. I'm just going to say, I absolutely apologize that the sound system is not working.
Don Lane apologizes.
There's two answers to this, and I know one of them is not viable. We could put this off, but you're all here, so we're not going to put it off. Because so many people have prepared to be here tonight, all the organizing that's been done. So we're going to do the best we can. I'm going to speak as loudly as I can. I invite every person who comes to the microphone to speak as loudly as they can. And we'll just do the best we can because there's a lot of people here who would like to be heard, and we have to proceed.
It is a little louder now. If you're speaking louder, just not a little louder.
Can people hear this? All right, people. You're not able to hear this?
No.
Keith McHenry is standing at the mic.
That's what they say is the mic, right?
Talk. Anyway, there's a lot of technical problems.
Hello? Hello?
So the substance
Hello?
Of this, I think, probably is going to have to wait until we... I guess I'm going to try to do
yeah,
it. If, perhaps on Sunday.
Is there any way to turn this mic up?
Provide a... an edited version of this, I suppose that's what we really need.
Just got to lean close to it.
So people can hear it?
Okay. Right, I think that
great,
actually
great.
Going to
okay,
be able to
maybe
hear
just
what's
have to hit it first and then it'll work. Okay. Hello? Hello? Hello?
Just so you know, the fire marshal is going to pass
Hello?
Down the aisles and is going to ask people to move
okay.
outside. We do need to have clear aisles and not exceed the capacity of the room. So
another thing that Lane could have done was to hold this whole thing in the
center. Yeah, can people sit in the press thing and on the ground?
Yeah, there's a where Mr. Norris is.
Yeah, people, there's a few seats on the ground here.
He could have held it in the larger Civic Auditorium across the street, which he chose not to do as well. There are all kinds of decisions that were made that limited public access and participation. And at the same time, he made some gestures which, you know, were intended to sort of soothe the crowd while he proceeded with acquiring the Bearcat, essentially giving the police department what it wanted. That's what he was proceeding to do. In other words, instead of actually considering rescinding this whole thing, which is what was being requested by hundreds of people, I think almost 1,000 people in a petition, he did what he did. Let's hear a little something else, and I'll be back. a slight technical difficulty in the studio, but I think we're gonna try it. I'm gonna continue. Skidmark Bob, down so fucking long, it looks like up to me. And we have a caller. Hi, caller.
Hi.
Hi.
I wanted to start the discussion, also pitch in or chime in on the discussion about the last city council meeting, and, you know, maybe some other people call in and give their opinions.
Sure.
Was it Steve? What's his name? Steve?
Steve Argue.
Argue. Argue. And,
he was a fellow who said, fuck this shit, in essence. And
Fuck this farce, or fuck this shit.
Something to that effect. And he was
I heard that, and I was kind of like, ooh, you know. And by the end of the meeting, I was saying the same thing. I mean, he just got to it earlier.
Yep.
I mean, from top to bottom, the whole thing was just a farce. I mean, it was just from the beginning of the meeting to the very end, when they're sharing their little stories about who's on what group doing what, it was just a farce. I know in previous years it's been the same thing. It's just maybe there was only three people in chambers, so it wasn't as obvious. But, you know, it started with the whole, well, we can't pull something off the consent agenda,
there was a claim for $200,000 or $300,000, which a a guy who painted a Hispanic mural.
Right,
at Beach
the mural
Flats,
in Beach Flats.
That was
right.
vandalized by the city workers.
Right.
Repainted, if you will.
Right. And I had read actually about that before, never heard anything else. I didn't know who that's the guy's name. I just heard, like, hey, did you hear about the mural in Beach Flats? And it was like, it was so through word of mouth. And so I was curious, like, well, who made the decision and how did that happen? And, you know, there's a lot to that no one's ever followed up on or explained. And I thought, boy, that would be an interesting thing for the city council, an interested city council, to just want to discuss, but nothing. I mean, not one person seemed even remotely interested in trying to figure out what went wrong in the city process.
And
I mean, they could care less.
And also, there were two of us who asked that it be removed from the count, from the agenda, maybe even three, at least two, myself and Steve Argue.
Uh-huh.
We both requested that it be removed from the consent agenda for discussion. And as I've said, you know, in my lengthy presentation, and repeat every time I come to the council, every other body that I know of, or most other bodies, certainly the Santa Cruz Board of Supervisors, most of the city councils in surrounding cities, don't require you to get the permission of a council member to
uh-huh.
take one of these items off the consent agenda, so it is required that they at least have a real public hearing on it.
Right.
So
right.
And the consent agenda is supposed to be articles and things that everybody agrees with. And
right.
If a member of the public wants to talk about it, that, you know, they have a right to. Now, they've gotten around this by saying, well, we're going to give you 2 minutes to talk about all 15 consent agenda items combined. And then if we decide we'll remove one, then we'll have a staff report and other people can talk about it too.
Right.
So
there's two parts there that's wrong. I mean, one is that first part of just the process. And then the second part was, given the bullshit process, there was no one who wanted to even go there. So that was just a farce.
And there was a third thing too.
Uh-huh.
Micah Posner, who the council member who I continue to, when I know him, because he's a friend of mine, personally say to him, I'm not sure how much of a friend these days, but, you know, why don't you just simply make a broad statement that if anybody wants an item pulled from the consent agenda, you'll do it. And therefore, you can stop this process of excluding everybody from the consent agenda access. And he said, well, I won't do that, but I will, if you want an item pulled, guarantee that you'll have an opportunity to speak on it. Well, he lied. This did
right.
not happen on this occasion. So.
Well, I would be interested in seeing if people, you know, we can contact people and see if it could be put on the regular agenda at some point, which is for the public course of public discussion is like what actually happened. You know, can the city get a report? Can members of the public ask? Because that was a long-standing mural. And I know that once I looked it up, because I tried to follow up, because I just heard through word of mouth, and when I finally followed up, there's like this little putty article in, the Sentinel. And, you know, they had some just blather about, you know, confusion, and it scared the children. The children were scared by, I don't know, it didn't even make any sense to me. So there's that. And then we went to the decorum bullshit.
Before you leave that last item, caller, I think I said this to the previous caller, I don't know if you were listening, I don't think we need to bring it back to the city council. I think we need to take it to the community, although the council may be an opportunity for people to gather. As I said, I think once we gather and we see that it goes nowhere, we need to use that opportunity to, you know, maybe go out to the Beach Flats and create our own new mural, go to the house of the guy who was, had his mural desecrated and, you know,
I agree
party
with that.
For him.
The only reason why I say bring it back is because that could create the rallying point to have people from Beach Flats come in and go, you never ask us anything. To have the guy come in and go, no one ever contacted me. To have other members of the community saying, this is par for the course how the city operates. You know, we do something and we don't care about really feedback.
Yeah, or just throw a fiesta in the Beach Flats and create our own mural there. You know, I mean, or it could also be going to the offices of the people who destroyed the mural and demanding accountability from them.
Right.
I mean, see, I am always wary of. I understand what you're saying. I mean, you know, it's a process to go back to the city council.
Well, I think it's. Yeah. I think you could do both. I actually think it's entirely possible that you can do both. The problem that I have is that where you sit there Well, we'll get to that. Where you go to the meeting and you think, well, there, we've done it. I don't think that's not even the beginning because,
correct,
as I said, the whole thing's a farce. So you shouldn't think that you've resolved anything by, like, the whole decorum thing. I mean, obviously that was set in stone. That was going to happen anyway. That was obvious. And then we got to, I don't know if you were there or, you know, listening or I couldn't tell who was where. But then you got to the oral communications, which, I was watching on stream until it cut out. So I kind of left for a while. And when I came back, there was the farce about the, heritage tree, which of course was a done deal. We knew that was going to happen because it was the Seaside Company that wants to cut down.
So let me explain to the audience what we're talking about here. The afternoon session had initially the consent agenda, which had this item of, you know, vandalized. The artist wants $300,000 to pay for his stuff, and
right,
claim was turned down. More important than that, the audience was not allowed to talk about it.
Nothing.
Except, you know, for 2 minutes on the mass talking about all consent agenda items.
Right.
Secondly, you had the decorum rules, which were, you know, essentially, people have said this, and I've kind of avoided using this designation, but these are really the rules to rein me in.
Right.
I'm the person who does these recordings. And
right. It's the let's shut up. We know what it was.
It's shut up,
yeah.
Norris rules, and
right,
and it's, you know, these rules were, you know, you can't. They put themselves into a tangle because they said, well, we don't allow unattended tape recorders anywhere in the room, which meant I had to put my chair next to the tape recorder and, you know, sit in front, which,
right,
which put them on the spot. So now they've changed that little spot over to the side.
Well, it's also the bullshit. Don't turn your back on us because we're royalty.
Yeah, yeah, that too. Yeah, and the more basic thing that if we declare it's a rule and you violate it, then you're disrupting our meeting.
Right.
Even
right,
if you're not disrupting our meeting.
Right.
That was
right,
the changes made in the decorum rules, which they rammed through or passed through like shit through a goose, with
right,
the great liberal Michael Posner agreeing as well.
Right.
I mean, it's like, you know, it's a sort of a, you want to really sort of separate yourself from that group. Because not only are they making the wrong decisions, but they have a kind of a malign sphere of influence around them. People who are trying to negotiate with them, dicker with them, do deals with them. I don't think it works too well. Go ahead.
Well, so then I went to, when I came back, I saw, I
the evening
I
agenda.
I'm not sure what I missed, but I came in on the part where there's a staff person presenting the why we need to cut down a tree,
nope,
yet another heritage tree.
Going on for quite a while, yeah.
And that was presented by the city staff, and of course it was glowing for the Seaside Company, which, no shock there, and Slattery Construction, who, you know, did all the research for Seaside, and they do all the work for Seaside. I mean, they do a ton of work for Seaside, so of course they're going to, all the pigs are going to be in line. And so what was interesting to me, though, is Jillian Greensight?
Yes, I think. Jillian Greensight.
Yeah. So she was, I guess, the appellant, and she gives this presentation, and I don't know shit about construction, but I thought she made some compelling, just what I was watching, some compelling arguments countering what was claimed actually by the city. And so she made, a very coherent presentation. And then when it goes to city council, one of the first people that attacks her, of course, is Pamela Comstock, who, her mode of attack was,
Are you an expert?
Are you an expert? Right. Like, you know, well, peon, we don't really want to hear from you, peon. We need to hear from the experts, i.e. my friends who have put a lot of money in my campaign coffers. And so she basically tried to shut her down, and she was trying to explain herself, and she keeps, are you an expert? Yes or no? You know, like she's some sort of,
district attorney?
Attorney, yeah. And I thought that was, you want to talk decorum, I thought that was so,
to the public,
professional. I just thought it was just, the whole thing was just farcical. You know, it was like saying, gee, fuck you. You know, just fuck you, and I'm going to try and do whatever I can to belittle you or embarrass you in front of the public. And I just thought, you want to worry about decorum, well, why don't you start with that? So I was pretty appalled at that. And of course, they, you know, voted to cut down the tree because that's Santa Cruz now. And then we got to the stay away, which was just a complete absolute farce, to the point that you had David, whatever his name is, admitting that, you know, he had this new proposal that he was going to add to make, like, sugarcoat the whole, we're going to criminalize the homeless by, we'll take statistics. That was his big, you know, sugarcoating. We're going to take statistics on, you know, who we...
It's a sort of a familiar process. We'll come back in 6 months and reexamine it. It was more specific than usual, and the reason it was more specific was because Raven Davis, who may yet call into the show...
I hope she does. If not, try and get her in, because that was... Yeah. That was fast. That whole part.
Let me explain
was
what she did. She and other Huff members researched who got stay away orders in the last year under the current stay away provision, which is itself unconstitutional, but only mandates staying away for a day from an area where you're given an infraction citation of any kind if the officer wants to give you a stay away order with no criteria for doing so. She or he can do whatever if she chooses to or not. The new law that was being proposed, and I say this even though I'm sure you and I both know it, caller, but there may be others who don't, is a retroactive law which states that if you are given a second stay away order within a year from an earlier stay away order, and again, most of the stay away orders Raven Davis found, we all found as we looked through these citations, which we had to go do by hand because the Parks and Rec director did not have those statistics available, even though she walked to the police, you know, she walked into the city council chambers and demanded this new law so that people who would not be scared away from hiring, doing wedding ceremonies in the park by the sight of, you know, unsavory homeless folks. Although, you know, I'm sure they've had problems. There were some people in the audience who talked about their bad experiences, and people I'm sure have had bad experiences. But none of the statistics that were shown by the, up on the screen, and now I'm getting back to why I raised this in the first place, which were created by Raven Davis looking through all these tickets, the rest of us helping, they were all for nonviolent work, nonviolent offenses like
right.
Smoking, camping, being in an area after dark, some for open container, I don't know, a couple of maybe for lying on the bushes or something, but 70% or 80% of them, let's be a conservative, were for offenses that are primarily homeless oriented. And the new stats that Raven has come out with today, she's crunched some more of the figures, has demonstrated that the stay away orders, a majority of them went to homeless people, and they went for homeless offenses. I think I have
ridiculous.
That right.
Just ridiculous. I mean, it's just the ones that were offered up by as that she read, had to read quickly because, you know, you only have 3 seconds to talk in front of our lords and masters. And
2 minutes. Well, I was like listening to Woody Woodpecker.
Yeah, she was little. And you know, I thought it was fascinating the information that was brought forward, and that Micah actually. You know, reiterated. Well, no one gave a shit, really. I mean, it was 6-1.
And that was the reason that David Terrazas gave this amendment, which said, well, come back in September and look at these stats, when in fact, what he, of course, needed to do was look at the stats that have been acquired over the last year under the same law.
Right.
Just for a day. I mean, you know, this,
right.
You know, and this is...
They had the stats, and that was clear. And Raven from the audience, you could hear her from the audience, even at least on the stream. You know, she's trying to correct, Comstock, and Comstock, of course, is like, shut up. I'm just trying to make my point to... I didn't even know what Comstock's point was, that, you know, well, what time of the day were these, you know, were these issued?
Well, because Comstock's point was that... She and Take Back Santa Cruz have a sort of a new wrinkle in how they're presenting things. And I believe they may even be sincere here, although, It's bizarre. It's a real cognitive dissonance here because they say we aren't interested in criminalizing homeless people. We don't care if they're around. It's just we don't want them bothering middle-class people during the day. What they do at night in the parks is their business. So she then got the cops to come up and say, oh, we only come out on complaint, and most of the tickets are not given during the day or night. That's the one thing we did not crunch in the stats. We don't have that figure yet as to the
time.
But
that could easily have been circumvented by a friendly amendment that would have altered what the actual ordinance said. But they didn't do that. And quite frankly, I heard that little wrinkle with Annalisa saying, well, I don't really care about, you know, the homeless. It's not about the homeless. And yet, when she did that, you know, everybody who's in favor of this as is, stand up, you know, and, you know, they had that big stand-up where everyone jumped up at attention and raised their right arm or whatever. That, it's incongruous what they're saying. I mean, there's a cognitive dissonance there, which is just a PR point. I don't buy it. Because if you really felt like, oh, well, we're really concerned about the homeless, then they would be making initiatives or making, they would have certain things within the amendment which would discount what otherwise is happening. So I don't buy that for one second.
It'd be interesting. It would have been interesting if Annalisa Cube had said, I would ask this council to amend this so that any tickets given before that this not apply to infractions that are nonviolent behavior
exactly
before 7 o'clock in the morning
exactly.
or before the opening of the parks
exactly
and that then that would have revealed a couple things. One, it would have clarified that, you know, we don't mind screwing with the homeless during daytime hours if they're anywhere near us. I mean, still the same anti-homelessophobia, but at least it would have said we acknowledge that, you know, it really makes no sense and it's really a waste of police time and parks and rec time and probably, you know, legally liable stuff.
Well, and it violates human rights. I mean,
well,
they're going to, you know.
Right. I mean, I don't think that's their primary concern. I think
they don't care.
Right. But, I mean, I think, you know, some of they'd like to, I'm sure they don't want to hurt innocent homeless people. They claim they're going after bad behavior. And I
right.
think they also think that there's, you know, there's a large bad element among the homeless, and therefore you got to kind of really exclude most of them in order to make sure you get rid of the bad behavior. And that's probably the mentality. But then the issue would have been, if she'd said that, the issue would have been for the city council, would they pay any attention to that, or would they simply go with Danette Shoemaker, who was simply saying, we've got to give the police more tools and the Parks and Ranger more tools, and even if some other group, in other words, I don't know, I think people tend to blame Take Back Santa Cruz for a lot of things, and I agree with that in many ways, but I also think this really predates Take Back Santa Cruz, this anti-homeless stuff.
Oh, I don't deny that it predates
it's part of the police department.
I was going to say, the only problem, though, is that it belies that, is that Pamela Comstock is, like, relative to Annalisa Cube, so it's not like she didn't have any pre-knowledge of any of this. And Rochelle Naroyan was, you know, when she was inducted last month or whatever, she was thanking Annalisa and Dexter Cube, so they're obviously, you know, they're connected. And so I find it hard to imagine that I think it was just a PR thing. Now, if that's not the case, then, you know, then certainly someone could come up and next week, you know, Take Back Santa Cruz could, you know, go in open communications and say, gee, we're really offended by this, you know, new law because it demonizes and it criminalizes people who are just engaging in trying to survive.
Well,
I don't think that's going to happen,
it's
though.
Too bad that we didn't have some of one of us wouldn't just say, look, you know, walk up there and say, Take Back Santa Cruz people, if you're sincere, come up to the microphone and ask the city council to modify the law so that it deals with violent behavior and not survival behavior by homeless people at night. None of us thought of that either. But my point is that this council, I think, really pays more attention to its staff than it does to Take Back Santa Cruz. It is, and its staff has been pushing this kind of shit for years. So
right.
I don't think, I mean, Take Back Santa Cruz is, you know, is a nice vocal excuse, and also they've got their people in some positions of power, no question about it. But the staff had this pro-police, pro-control, run-them-out-of-town mentality. This has been the standard rap for 30 years here
right.
in Santa Cruz.
Right.
So we have to understand that and they're the ones with the real power. I mean, Take Back Santa Cruz does have a lot of people on Facebook, and they can bring some. We brought more people to city council on this last meeting than they did. And,
right.
You know, and they can run people and effectively get some people in power. But the people who stay in power are in the staff. They've been there for years. They're doing the same thing. They are supporting their buddies in the police department. And, you know, they can, you know, if Danette Shoemaker asks for it, if Kevin Vogel asks for it, if they tell us, that's holy writ. You know?
Absolutely. I agree.
Yeah.
I mean, I agree. So, you know, the discussion, I agree about the whole farce thing. So the discussion, I still think, is to start to open it up in the community, which is what are our ways to combat this? And I think that's a question for everyone to chime in. You know, how are we going to open up new fronts? How are we going to not just make it at a city council meeting and thinking, well, that's done. So, and that's what I sort of opened up for other people to call in, not just this week, but, you know, it's going to be continual because, you know, there's some big stuff on the table now.
Yeah, and as I said, I'm planning, Huff members are planning to get together on Saturday to try to cook up some. I'm looking for a small protest. Some other Huff members have bigger visions of repeating the January 13th protests of 2 days ago. I'm less, I think I'm less ambitious than that. But it will be meeting on the steps of the post office at 3 or 3:30 on Saturday if anybody's interested, and I invite people to come, yourself included.
Okay, thank you. And I look forward to hearing what new information Raven has, because I found her research really interesting.
Sure. And I hope she calls in.
I do, okay. I'll hang up now. Hopefully she can get in.
Thanks.
Thank you.
And I want to remind you that there are two phone numbers, listeners. One is the one that you just heard from our caller on, 427-3772. The other is at 469-3119, 469-3119. I'm going to read the stay-away ordinance so people know what we've got here after I take this next call, of course. Hi, you're on Free Radio with me. Hello? Hello? Can you hear me? Hello? Hello? Say something if you're there, please, please. Okay, let's try again. Again, 427-3772 or 469-3119. This is the ordinance. Any person who receives a citation or is arrested on city, park, or beach property or any property maintained by Parks and Recreation Department for a violation of the Santa Cruz Municipal Code or state law may be ordered by the citing arresting order, may be ordered, it's a choice of the officer, at the time of the citation or arrest to vacate that park or beach property and not to reenter said property again for the period of time specified below. Any such order shall apply to both the park or beach property which the citation arrest occurs, and this is significant, people didn't quite understand this, it was clarified for Michelle Naroyan, to any other park or beach property at which such an order was issued within the previous year. This means it's retroactive. So if people have been getting one-day stay-away orders and at least 600 or 700 people, or at least 600 or 700 citations have been issued, I would suggest that probably means hundreds of people have gotten them, they would be getting stay-away orders for longer periods of time and greater spaces, more places to be excluded from. Any person who violates such an order from a city officer shall be guilty of a misdemeanor. That's punishable by a $1,000 fine or a year in jail as a maximum. First offense, 24 hours from the time of the citing arresting order. Second offense, within 1 week of the first offense, 1 week from the date of the citing arresting officer's order in response to the second offense. Third offense, within 30 days of the second offense, and you get a 30-day stay out. Fourth offense, within 6 months, you get a 6-month stay out. And fifth offense, within a year, you get a year stay out. Here's a caller. And I saw something in that I didn't see before, an interesting point. Hi, caller, you're on Free Radio.
Hey, can I get on Robert's show?
Well, I would say so. Why not?
Thank you.
Sure. This must be the infamous RD.
Yes, it is.
Well, Raven Davis, I have your the statement that you quickly got through. You talk much faster than I do at the city council about myths and facts. And I think that was the statement you gave at the city council on Tuesday night, was it not?
Yes, it was.
And what I just noticed in this ordinance is not only that you get if you are, you know, getting your second offense, let's say, and it's within 1 week of the first offense. Now that's interesting. I'm afraid I'm going to have to retract something I said. while it is true that, if an order was issued within the previous year, it's one thing, but you cannot get a second offense unless it happens within 1 week of the first offense. So what that may mean is that these orders are not retroactive, as I had thought. It's something I'm noticing in the ordinance that I hadn't seen before. Were you aware of that, Raven?
Oh, yes. It's this weird step ladder where if you get caught after you get your first 24-hour offense, then it gets extended to a week. And if you get caught during the week, it gets extended to a month. And then if you get caught during the month, it gets extended to 6 months. And then if you get caught during 6 months, it gets extended to a year. All of which is a bit of overkill, because after you get caught at any of those times, actually, you also get a misdemeanor. So it seems a bit silly, actually, that they even have this whole stepladder process.
That's a very important, I think, consideration. But I think I'm glad you. It is an interesting stepladder process, the way you describe it, and it's also overkill. Good points. Go ahead.
It's definitely the case, and it's also one of the things that really shows us that this is probably, you know, it's not intentionally aimed at homeless people, because who else is really going to get, you know, this many stayaways so close together, you know, that it would accumulate where you could be cited twice in 1 week or twice in 1 month in the same place? Well, you know, a lot of homeless people find places that work for them in these parks, and that's their spot. You know, they keep that same spot, and they keep getting tickets in the same place over and over again.
It has to be said, though, that this is at night or when the park is closed, and so it does not involve any kind of disturbance of the kind that you hear the outraged citizens talking about two nights ago. But it should also be stated that the reason that the misdemeanor, that they don't regard it as overkill, is because they have to impanel a jury to convict someone of a misdemeanor. They would have to, I mean, or unless they can get someone to plea bargain, which they usually do, but if a homeless person and an activist wanted to fight this and said, and supported homeless people, and you came back, you know, I don't know, 24 hours after or a day later or whatever, and you stayed there, and they said, okay, you're here, we arrest you, misdemeanor, they would have to convict that person by impaneling 12 people. And that might be hard to do. It would also be expensive. So instead of that, they have the stay-away orders, which don't even have to go to court.
Right. If you want to appeal them, all you have to do is go to the city manager.
And they've created this kind of bogus process, which says if you show up, you have to go to the city manager within 10 days of the offense, and then you have to show by a preponderance of the evidence, not that the stay-away order is unjustified. There's no criteria for the stay-away order. It's completely at the discretion of the officer, but that the infraction was not done, so that you weren't in the park after dark, that you weren't asleep, or that you weren't smoking. Those are the three main things, as I understand it.
Yes, that is exactly it. The three top things were camping citations. I did collapse those into one, although I can tell you right now that it was setting up a campsite at any time of day, actually, that got, you know, the highest out of all citation charges from Parks and Rec. But once you collapse it with the sleeping at nighttime, which is also a pretty high percentage, and having bedding, it jumps up to 38% of all charges given by park rangers, and mostly to homeless people. And then the next one would be limitations of access and use of public property, which, as you stated, is mostly people being, you know, in the park at nighttime when the park is closed and not accessible to the public, but also just being standing in the wrong spot at any park or public space, standing in a spot that the city has deemed not admissible for public, you can get a citation. And apparently, if I'm with my recent data crunching, those are the only, of the top three, those are the only citations that are given fairly equally to both people who give residential addresses but who also are homeless. So I guess people of all sorts like to just stand in the wrong place, because I doubt that these places are very clearly designated. I'll admit to walking around the parks, and I have no idea if I'm in a place that's off limits most of the time. And then, yes, the third top charge was for smoking on public property,
which, yes, smoking is very bad for, you know, your lungs and other people's lungs, and, you know, secondhand smoke is a serious thing, but it's also the kind of thing that you're more likely to be caught doing outdoors if you're a homeless person. I ran the numbers, and it would seem that you're twice as likely to get a smoking ticket with a stay away on top of that if you are a homeless person. And these are statistically significant numbers. You know, I'm running tests to check for independence, meaning is the chance of receiving a stay away independent of your housing status? And the answer is no. It's just a flat out, it's a very strong correlation actually between being houseless or giving an address that's not residential and getting a stay away. And honestly, some of these people getting stay aways who do give residential addresses, I'm pretty sure are actually homeless using someone else's address or an old address because there's a significant amount of camping citations to people with residential addresses. But really, who's out there camping between 11:30 p.m. and 8 a.m. in the morning, you know, or 8:30 a.m. in the morning, it's probably not someone who actually has a home because they have no reason to be in a Santa Cruz park at that time. It's probably someone who's recently lost their home who's doing that. So it's a fun game of sort of whack-a-mole when it comes to charges and who's giving them and when they're getting them and all of that. You can jump around, but in the end, the pattern's the same. You know, it's still homeless people who get the short end of the stick.
Now, you've been kind of, you know, involved in researching this for on and off for about the last 4 or 5 months. You've gone to City Hall. You've, I know you made it to the police station, too, I believe. Is that, I'm not sure if you were with us when we did that. I think you were, weren't you?
I've done some things at the police station. Not a whole lot of number crunching there, just helping you guys tally some of the numbers up. But I've definitely been at City Council since mid-October when the first version of this new ordinance that extends the stayaways came about, which I will just, you know, since we're shouting out Pamela Comstock today on your show, I really loved her comment about how she's seen this 3 times and she was very tired of debating it and just wanted to pass it regardless of what it said because she didn't want to talk about it anymore. And I was going to continue shouting as I had been during that City Council meeting. I really want to shout, well, it's been before you 3 times, but Ms. Noroyan and Ms. Chase have not seen it before. So why don't we give them a chance to actually test it out a bit and ask some questions? And
of course, they didn't have much in the way of questions. I guess Noroyan did, she was confused about the retroactiveness or about the fact that that the area keeps getting expanded. The first time you get, you know, kicked out, the second and third and fourth time, it includes all the prior times and all the prior places you were kicked out of, and then you have to, you know, stay away from all those places for a longer period of time on top of dealing with any misdemeanor citations that come up. I mean, it seems like a fear measure, really designed to frighten people into staying away, and also to maybe encourage a certain mentality of person that the authorities are doing something to secure safety and order and decorum in the parks.
Oh, for sure. I can see Sean Arroyo's confusion because as soon as they went to their 5-minute break, before they made the final decisions on this proposal, she made a beeline to the Parks and Rec Department. I was standing right in the corner when she walked over to them. And I was very clear that they didn't give her the best information about what this would really mean for anybody, only, you know, probably advising her to just, you know, pass it. You know, we're doing the right thing. You should believe us. Trust
now,
us.
Who is this? Who made the beeline?
Rochelle Noroyan. I have a picture. Check out Huff's Twitter. I got a picture of her with the head park ranger and Danette. they had a lengthy conversation during that 5-minute break.
Did you hear the conversation? Was there any new information that?
I didn't get to hear the conversation. I figured if they were colluding, then I should try to catch up with someone like Micah. But of course, he kind of blew me off before I could really get to him, but he did do most of his duty that I asked of him. you know, we had kind of playing a little bit of email tag leading up right up to the
what did you,
final decision.
How much contact did you have with Councilmember Posner? And what, it looked to me like not much happened because he was, you know, he did try to make an exception for sleeping, but that would have meant, okay, you know, you won't get ticketed for sleeping, but you will get ticketed for being in the park after dark. So it's the same thing, and you'll get stay-away orders for that. So I guess if you find a place that's open at night, you can try to lie down there and not get a stay-away order. I guess that would be a minor improvement. But and on any Parks and Rec property that's closed at night, it wouldn't be. But what was the nature of your discussions with him by email and at the council?
Well, not very much. I tried to get an appointment with him when he first opened his office hours, I think just before the new year, and he was a no-show, and I didn't bother trying to reschedule because we had already discussed at decent length when my appointment would be. And I emailed Cynthia Chase, actually, at the behest of our good man, Jim Weller, from Peace United, and she never responded to me. However, a week later, I got a response, or I got copied on an email between her and Micah, Councilman Posner, saying that I was the person to talk to about, you know, all this data. He sent her a copy of my data, and then that was about it. He asked, you know, he basically asked if I would be at the meeting this Tuesday. I replied back and I said yes. During the meeting, I jotted down some thoughts, emailed them to him, you know, some questions I didn't get asked. And he did sort of incorporate them to a small extent, but obviously we didn't really get to engage very much in a dialogue. So really it was him taking my data into his own hands and making his own decisions.
What I would like you to do, if I can, is even if we play your speech, I think it is given at such a speed that it's hard for people to, you know, keep up with it. I'm wondering if you'd be willing, do you have a copy of your speech present?
I do have a copy of my speech present.
Would you, I mean, do you think it's still apropos or there'd be stuff you'd want to change or...
There's only one thing I would want to change. I had 1% off by 1%. I wrote down 70% instead of 69. But I can definitely fix that as I go.
You're having a little problem with the phone. Are you on a cell phone or how?
I am on a cell phone.
It's kind of going, it's going out like this and it's kind of coming in and
okay.
out.
Okay.
How about, well, yeah, maybe we just proceed anyway, but why don't you give the speech in a leisurely manner, in the manner that you would have liked to if you had a chance to do so, because you're going to give you the chance now.
Oh, thank you, Robert.
Thank you, Raymond.
So I just want to address some myths that have been said about this law, this ordinance that would extend the stay-aways up to a year for repeat offenders. And the first myth, is that this law is not about homelessness, it's about criminal behavior. And the fact of the matter is, the behaviors of 82% of homeless people in Santa Cruz County are criminal, because 82% of homeless people in Santa Cruz County are unsheltered, and they set up camp and bedding on public property, they sleep in their cars. All of that is illegal in the city and the county of Santa Cruz. So, these people, these homeless people with no place to go, are criminals. Myth, this will rid parks of drug users, violent offenders, and verbal harassers. That fact is only true if such offenders are arrested or cited. If I may use some anecdotal evidence, I've spoken to people who support this amendment on the grounds of it curbing harassment and public drug usage. These same people, including one staff member from the Parks and Rec Department, who the director of the Parks and Rec Department decided to cite herself, I spoke to this man, and, you know, he admitted that harassers will, you know, be in your face and be loud, and tend to leave before any officer of the law, be it a park ranger or a police officer, can arrive and detain them or cite them. Unfortunately for that staff member, this law only applies to criminals who are caught. So if the SCPD and the park rangers are not cracking down on those kinds of criminals, then those kinds of criminals are not the ones who will be receiving these orders to vacate or these stay-away orders. What's interesting enough is that between January 2013 and October 2014, the Parks and Rec Department only gave out one citation, a single citation, out of 1,166 tickets for disorderly conduct. In between Parks and Rec, the Santa Cruz Police Department, between Parks and Rec and the Santa Cruz Police Department, only 23 people were actually caught in violation of their order to vacate out of 1,000 orders to vacate that were given. So what's interesting here is that they're probably trying to really up this crackdown on people who are violating their stay-aways, because they only caught 23 people doing it who needed to be arrested for their misdemeanor at all last year. And almost all of those were people who were arrested by the Santa Cruz the Police Department, which is quite interesting. Another myth is that a crime is a crime and a criminal is a criminal. And that holds true if all crimes and all criminals are given equal treatment, but they're not. The top three citations, including infractions